Bud Powell at the piano, his version of Body and Soul, and before that we heard Blue Chopsticks, which featured Herbie Nichols at the piano. This is Fresh Air, and you're listening to WUHY FM in Philadelphia. It's now 9 minutes to 4 o'clock, and in the studio with me now is Dave Arnold for a very special information feature and some guests. David?
Well, thanks, Terry. I do have some guests with me today. You know, it has come to our attention that many of our listeners are curious about some of the more technical aspects of radio. So, being ever ready to please, we've invited several experts to Fresh Air today to discuss some of the more elusive points in the sound recording process. Now, we've spared no expense or effort to bring you this special report. And our first guest, Terry, I'm really happy to say, is someone that many of our listeners have seen both in movies and on television. I believe he was born in Europe, but for many years now, more than any of us can remember, he's made his permanent home in Anaheim, California. And he's been setting up in the next studio for about the past 15 minutes now. Is he ready yet? Is he ready? Good, good, good. Yeah, he seems to be ready. So let's go to him now. And Terry, he's Professor Ludwig von Drake.
Now, I'm going to explain a little bit more about a recording. Now, the most important thing about a recording is not the people that makes the music. It's the engineer, the man who stands there and works the tape machines and everything. Now, you ask any engineer or man who works the tape machines, and he will tell you he is the most important thing to any recording. The musicians mean nothing, the singers, the dancers. None of them mean nothing. And it's true, because if you don't have a good engineer, you're never going to get to Cleveland. Now, I'm going to tell you about tape. Now, I'll tell you about tape. Now, you take a piece of tape like this, and you put one piece over here on one side of the mouth, one piece on this. What am I doing? That's the wrong kind of tape I got over there. You're on a tape machine, you don't use that kind of a tape, like for bandages or something like that. It's altogether different. Now, you put the tape on this side, and then you put it through a little thing over here, and then you twist it around over there, and you put another reel here, and then you turn on the machine, and here's what you hear on the tape. But that's backwards. Well, I'm going to fix that. You see, when you hear a tape that's put on backwards like that, it sounds, you know, like it's real ridiculous. But that isn't the way it is, because then when you turn it around and you play it forward, we're going to retread it over here. I put it over here, play it forward for you, and now you are going to see what it really sounds like. Now listen to this. This is altogether different. Do you ever hear anything like that? What is he saying? I don't even know what he's talking about. That's the silliest dialogue I didn't understand him either way. But anyway, let's get back to the tape machines and all of this other kooky stuff like the stereophononic microphones and all the different things they got now. But one of the most interesting things you're going to find in a recording studio, and you go into them, and you say you want to see the echo chamber. Now, if the red light is on in the recording studio, don't go in, because that means that somebody's recording. And if you open the door, you make any kind of a noise, it's going to disturb it. Because, like right at this moment, nobody would think of making any kind of noise, because they know that I am recording and I'm a big artist. So they are keeping everything as quiet as they possibly can, because they know that I'm recording. And I appreciate that, gentlemen, that you have kept everything nice and quiet for me while I'm recording. Back to the echo chamber. That's where we left it. If you remember, we left you in the echo chamber. Now, what are you doing in the echo chamber? I'll tell you what you are doing. You are getting echoes. And here's the way the echoes go. Hello?
Hello?
How are you?
Fine.
That's good.
Thanks.
How's Sarah and the kids?
Fine.
Come over to supper sometime.
I will.
You see, that's the way. Wait a second, what are we doing here? Talking here to an echo? I talking to the echo all by myself? That's not supposed to be like that. An echo is yourself. You hear your own voice is coming back at you, like when you're in the mountains, it's the same thing. So now here you are, and we go into the echo chamber, a nice big dark room, and there's nothing to be afraid of here, because there's probably only ghosts or something. But a ghost? What am I saying in here in the echo chamber? Let me out of it! Open up the echo chamber here! What are you doing with it? Boy, I thought we're never gonna get out of that place. That's the last time that I let you talk me into going into an echo chamber.
Professor Ludwig von Drake, who was brought here at great expense to Fresh Air. And Terry, we can thank our own Leanne Hansen, who made all the arrangements in order to bring Ludwig here from the coast. Well, now that we've gotten a very firm background in the basics of both tape and echo chambers, not to be overlooked as a recording technique, we can move to the next great technical advance in recording. And in fact, this advance is probably the greatest one since Edison and the cylinder machine. And of course, I'm referring to stereophonic sound. Now, the development of stereo opened up a seemingly limitless possibilities for experimentation. So this next segment of our survey is really well-suited for those of our listeners who are listening on stereophonic receivers. And it would even be better if those who can could listen to this next part through a pair of stereo headphones. It would just enhance the beauties of stereophonic sound. And so I'd like to introduce my next guest who's with us today in the studio, Terry. And he's here to take us on a tour of some of the many possibilities afforded by stereophonic sound. And his name is Peter Allen.
Audio Fidelity Records presents a new stereophonic sound spectacular. The world of stereo is filled with spectacular sound surprises. As I was saying, stereo is full of surprises. In an instant, stereo can magically transport you to the concert hall. Or to a bowling alley. Or to a jazz band ball. Here's a vocalist we all know.
I went down to St. James Infirmary. Saw my baby there. She was stretched out on a long white table. So cold, so sweet, so vast.
All of us are born with the miraculous ability to determine the direction from which sounds approach us. We're able to tell in an instant where a particular sound comes from. In fact, we have an instinctive emotional need to be able to orient ourselves in terms of sound sources. Therefore, stereophonic reproduction offers us the most natural and satisfying way of listening to recorded sound. Through the miracle of stereo, all of the brilliant sound, the dynamic presence, the complete situational aspect of a great orchestra or a great event can be reproduced in what is virtually a live performance in your very own living room.
No!
No!
Not the mandolins!
Anything but the mandolins!
Anything? Well, Dave, we've covered the echo chamber, stereo, and we move on now to the machine that encompasses these and still more technical feats. I'm referring to the synthesizer. The synthesizer is often used as the instrument for what is often called space rock, as well as for avant-garde classical music compositions. Dave, in the piece we're about to hear, it seems the composer writing for the synthesizer was highly influenced by the recordings he listened to as a youngster, which in this case seems to have been stereo demonstration records.
Welcome to the wonderful world of stereo. Welcome to the wonderful world of stereo. Total dimension, stereophonic, high fidelity sound. Welcome to part two, setting up and adjusting your stereo hi-fi set. Without moving from between the speakers, you'll be capable of transforming the space around you into the hushed silence of the concert hall, just moments before that silence is shattered by the full power of a Philharmonic Symphony Orchestra. Moments later, you'll find yourself at ringside for the world heavyweight title, and then in Yugoslavia, haggling for bargains in the open-air market. You can almost smell the fish just beyond the left speaker. All this in the comfort of your own home. In a few easy steps, I'll guide you through all you have to know to properly adjust speaker phase relationship, volume balance between left and right channels, tone control, automatic gain control, squelch, automatic frequency control, scratch filter, anti-skate, speed adjustment, reverberation, speaker placement,
police band scanner,
reverberation, police band scanner,
loudness,
tape bias,
rumble filter,
loudness,
Conrad
rumble filter,
Conrad
alert,
IHF,
RMS,
RFI IHF. RFI block.
Frequency
harmonic
response.
Distortion.
Flutter.
Frequency response.
Wow.
Flutter. Wow.
Error.
Tracking error. And finally, impedance matching. Let's start from scratch. Disconnect the right channel speaker. Now the left channel speaker. Nothing should be done until both volumes are equal. Next, speaker placement. You'll get true, natural sound only when the two speakers are the proper distance apart. That's a bit too far apart. That's better. Now that your system is properly adjusted, you're ready for years of trouble-free listening. There's very little that can do any real damage to this precision-engineered equipment. However, do avoid prolonged listening at high volumes to such sounds as... the repeated playing of well, you should be all set. Good evening, and the best of listening to the wonderful world of stereo.
That's entitled Stereo Demonstration a la 1957. It was written in 1975 by Walter Gajewski, who's a new music composer based in Buffalo, New York. The voice you heard was that of John Farrell, who is also based in Buffalo, New York. Well, Dave, there are many other people to be thanked for this little educational session.
Well, that's true, Terry. We already thanked our own Leanne Hansen, who made the travel arrangements for Professor Ludwig von Drake. We'd also like to mention that the stereo demonstration record that we heard before was from 1963 from Audio Fidelity Records. And we'd like to thank our technical director, Jay Goldman. And last but not least, we'd love to thank that great one, Thomas Alva Edison.
And I'd like to thank you, Dave. You're listening to Fresh Air. We've been listening to Charles McPherson, Stranger in Paradise. This is Fresh Air. On the telephone with me now is Pete Hill, and he is one of the many people who are now being held in New Hampshire in various armories. He is at the Manchester Armory because of his and their participation in a demonstration 2 weekends ago protesting the proposed, at the construction site of the Seabrook nuclear power plant. More than 2,000, I believe, that according to the New York Times, people gathered at the nuclear power plant construction site in Seabrook, New Hampshire, to protest the plant. They set up camp and refused to leave. The police dispersed this act of civil disobedience by arresting about 1,414 demonstrators over a 14-hour period. About 1,000 of the demonstrators are still being held in National Guard armories. They're refusing to post bond because they think they should be released on their own recognizance. This, by the way, was the largest, to my knowledge, demonstration staged against a nuclear power plant that's ever happened in this country. Now, let me just explain that Pete Hill is on the phone now. There are a few people lined up in back of him who will be speaking to us. Each person is allowed only 5 minutes to speak on the telephone at the armory. Hi, Pete.
Hi. I'm about 3 minutes down on my 5, I'm afraid.
Right. Okay. Well, let's get into it. Listen, tell me a little bit about the conditions there. According to the New York Times, I've been getting very varied reports. They say on the one hand that people are throwing frisbees and dancing, staging talent shows, but I know that the ACLU is suing $5,000 a day per prisoner for cruel and unusual punishment. What are the conditions like?
Well, it's a combination. We're high in spirit and low in body, and we're doing it all out of ourselves, the good creative stuff that make this, in a sense, a celestial picnic. It's a very, very high atmosphere. I have a very bad chest cold, and so do a whole lot of other people. And there's lots of physical things that are wrong, but we are high in spite of the condition. Physically, you know, there's five toilets for a couple of hundred, 200-300 people of one sex at a time. There's four showers that work for all of us, and we alternate on those. You know, and we eat on the floor. But we eat royally because we're people in a very fine place in our spirits and our souls, and so it's awful as a prison. It's great as a place to be for an action. And I just got told I got a half a minute left. So I'm not going to get to tell you about what happened this morning, but the next person will.
Okay, well, Pete, thanks for sharing your 5 minutes of time with us.
Yeah.
I really appreciate your
yeah.
being there. Okay, so
I just would like to say that I have learned this morning more about nonviolent direct action and that Gandhi was, in fact, right, that we can do it that way. And I knew it somewhat in my head before today, and because of what happened between 6 and 9 o'clock this morning, it's real. It is really real. And I'm going to leave you good folks, and there'll be a little dead time because I'm going to leave the thing off the hook, and the next person will come in and pick it up.
Okay.
Love to you all. Hope to see you in a week or two back in West Philly.
Okay, well, thank you, Pete Hill.
So long.
Bye-bye. What we're doing now is waiting for the next person. Each person at the Manchester Armory is allowed 5 minutes of time on the telephone. So a number of people from the Philadelphia area are lined up by this one telephone, and they'll give us their 5 minutes of time and then leave when someone knocks at the door to tell them their time is up and the next person will come in. Is anyone there yet? I think the next person online is David Alpert. Again, we're talking about what the conditions are like in the armories where the demonstrators at the Seabrook Power Plant in New Hampshire, where they have been incarcerated. They've been there for, I guess, about 10 days now. And again, they're allowed 5 minutes of time each. We're waiting for the next person. Do I hear a voice on the other end of the phone?
Hello, Terry.
Hi.
Hi, Bill Moyer here.
Oh, hi. How are you?
Fine.
Bill Moyer has shared with us his views about nuclear power previous times on Fresh Air. How are you, Bill?
Doing fine right now. I guess this is our 8th day? No, 10th day?
10th day, I think it is. Yeah. Are you healthy? Are you healthy?
Yes.
Good. Okay, listen, I want to hear about the action this morning. Pete didn't really have enough time to tell us about it.
Right, yeah. We only have 5 minutes on the phone at a time, and it usually takes 4 minutes to get through to someone. I think in an effort to... last night we were notified that 31 people in this armory were having their trials moved... up from next month or 2 months from now up to this morning, and that at 7:15 that they were going to be taken away in police vans to have their trial. And we of course thought that this was illegal, since we had trial dates before, we were not legally notified, and we thought this was a scare tactic to scare people, the rest of us, to get out on bail rather than to be in here to have these fast trials. And we didn't have time to talk to our lawyers, and it would be also a method of splitting our people up, that we've, you know, gotten a good solidarity together and working well together in this armory, and everyone who was to go out to the court today was going to be split up off into other armories and not coming back to this one, and they were going to split the men and the women into separate other armories. And we felt that this was really unfair and illegal, and also that it was psychological terrorism doing this late at night and to divide us up. So we met in small groups. I guess there's, I don't know, 350 people here at this point, or maybe 400, I'm not sure. And we worked through much of the last night and into the morning hours trying to figure out how can we have a good response, a good human response back to the state of New Hampshire. It's fairly clear that this was not coming from the local court system, but was really coming down as a political strategy from the governor of New Hampshire, who has been running the strategy that's kept us in this jail for 9 or 10 days for trespassing. And so we decided in the last night, and then did this in the morning, that at 7:15 we were told that these 31 people had to report at the front of the armory to leave. And instead of doing that, we decided that we would not have the people leave, but we would resist by all of us getting up even earlier than that. We got up at 6 a.m. and had breakfast and sat in the middle of the armory floor, 350 people huddled together singing freedom songs and anti-nuclear energy songs and resistance songs. And at about 7:15, when the commander of the armory went on the loudspeaker to list the 31 names, that we started singing louder so that we could not hear the names read, so the people did not know that they were being notified. And this went on for about an hour. Every 15 minutes, they would say the names on the loudspeaker, and we would be singing and couldn't hear them. And at the same time, we had a negotiation team talking personally with the leadership of the state police here and the National Guard, who are running the armory.
So you're pretty confident that individuals from the group won't be brought off to trial now?
Yes. Well, what happened after an hour or so of this, that we were notified that they have pictures of the 31, and they were going to come down on the floor and drag out the 31 people by looking at their mug shots from the arrest. But that drug on for a while before they decided to do that. And finally, word came through at the last minute, when it seemed they were going to have state troopers come on the floor, that the word came in that the trials today were canceled. And that just erased that whole confrontation of that problem. We're now negotiating with the state in terms of when these trials are going to occur. And I think that they backed way off from a position which the state seems to have had of just completely running roughshod over our legal rights and over the normal processes by which the court system is run. That we are law-abiding citizens, and we're working through the court system, and the governor and the attorney general of the state seem to be doing quite a bit to try to use various kinds of illegal means of that's the guard knocking on the door.
Your time's up,
okay.
Huh?
Of squelching and squashing citizens who are trying to raise questions about the way the state and the large utilities are forcing atomic energy onto the people of the United States. And I think this is really symptomatic of the way they're squashing us, is the same process by which atomic energy plants are being put on the American people without the information and without the dialogue. And what we're trying to do here is put a spotlight on that issue and take this immoral social condition of the large corporations forcing atomic energy on the public, and we're putting a spotlight on it to make that immoral situation a public issue. And I hope that we've been doing that sitting in here this past 8 days. Okay.
Bill, listen.
I'll have someone else, or shall I hang up?
No, have someone else in.
Okay.
And I hope that I hope that you're okay and that you continue to be okay during your stay there at the Armory. And also, do give us a call here at the station when you get back to Philadelphia.
When would be a good time to call? Like tomorrow?
Sure. Listen, as soon as you're back, call any time at the station.
Okay, bye.
Great.
Hold on.
Be well, Bill. Okay, listen, we are on the telephone to the Manchester Armory in New Hampshire. There are a number of people from the Philadelphia area who are standing outside the door where the telephone is. The situation is that each of the people by the phone only gets 5 minutes to stay on the phone, hence the line. The people from Philadelphia are sharing their time with us this afternoon so that we can find out firsthand what the conditions are like inside the armories, where people who were protesting at the site of the Seabrook nuclear reactor are now being incarcerated. As Bill Moyer, who we were just speaking to, who's from West Philadelphia, explained this morning, they staged a movement, an action. The police there were trying to take individuals from the people who were in the armory to court, to trials. The trials were supposed to be later, but they moved up the time.
Hello?
Oh, hello. Hi. Who are we speaking with?
This is David Tackenhorst.
Hi. How are you?
Real good.
Good.
Just getting over a cold.
Have you gotten to see a doctor if you needed one?
Pardon?
Have you gotten to see a doctor if you needed one? Are there doctors available?
They've been available, but I got sick on Sunday, so that I didn't get to see a doctor. But they took a strep throat culture on that day,
mm-hmm.
and still haven't heard the results of that.
Listen,
but it's coming out all right. I'm feeling a lot better.
Good, glad to hear it. Bill was telling us about the action that you did this morning.
Yeah, I was one of the people who was going to be sent to court this morning.
Uh-huh.
So that was quite a hairy experience for me.
Do you want to explain to us why it's important for you to get released on your own recognizance instead of paying bail while you're holding out on bail?
Pardon?
Do you want to explain to us why you're trying to get released on your own recognizance instead of paying bail?
Well, we feel that that everyone should be released on personal recognizance, that some people will not be able to afford the bail, which is set at $100. So the original idea was especially for the people who were second-time occupiers and might have a higher bail set. Now, this didn't happen, but there are still some people who are not able to afford bail. So we wanted to maintain solidarity with those people and make sure that everyone could be released at the same time.
When you decided to participate in this demonstration, did you have any idea that you would end up being held in jail for 10 days?
No, not at all.
What were you expecting?
I really wasn't expecting it, but it's been a really beautiful experience, and I think that for all of us here, it's been quite consciousness-raising.
When you participate in a civil disobedience action and resign yourself to going to prison if necessary, I think often in the back of your mind is the fact that it's you're going to have a record, you know, that for one way or the other, it's going to be there and maybe come back at you. Were you ever worried about that, or are you willing to just accept that?
Yeah, I just pushed through those fears and for this action, and I think that in the future, I won't have that problem anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Because acting in terms of one's conscience, I just have to feel that that the important thing is that moral stand, and that I can explain that
mm-hmm.
in the future.
Have you gotten to see, or has anyone else in the armory gotten to see a lawyer?
There have been lawyers available. Not for everyone. There's been very little time to see lawyers. They've been mostly in court. But there have been paralegal attorneys available to speak to the whole group. We have felt that it was a really hard thing that we haven't been able to see lawyers individually, and we're hoping that will be remedied soon.
Mm-hmm. What kind of communication, if any, do you have with the town that you're being held in? Do you know at all how the people who live there
are really interesting that when we make these phone calls and we talk to the operator, they can tell that we're in the armory because of this echo in this little room. And they'll immediately say, oh, you must be in the armory. And the interaction is usually very friendly. judging, that's my only way of judging that the town's reception is rather favorable. Of course, the town newspaper is quite another story. We get it in here every day, and it's quite a reactionary paper, and the stories are always unfavorable. But there's two papers.
What about the day of the demonstration? What kind of reaction did you get from the community?
In Seabrook itself, the reaction was quite favorable as well. Cars went by the demonstration, honked their horns, waved, gave a peace sign. On our whole length of the walk, which was 3 miles long, I only counted two people who seemed to be at all unfavorable.
Can you describe for us, David, the space that you're in so we could just get a sense of what it's like for you there now?
In the armory?
Yeah.
Yeah, the armory is like a large field house. It's kind of maybe the size of two basketball courts. And for the first 3 days, we were on cement floors sleeping. And then we've been given cots since then. The space is roped off, so we're instructed to stay inside of the roped off space unless we're coming out to make phone calls and stuff. But there are guards standing around the outside of the rope, one or two now, after they found out that we weren't so dangerous. And they've given us a lot of leeway. So he just came and instructed me my time was up.
Oh, okay.
It's been really nice talking to you.
Thanks so much for sharing your time with us.
Yeah, I hope I'll send somebody else in.
Okay, thanks very much, David. That was David Packenhurst, and we'll be speaking to one more person from the Manchester Armory. Again, if you're just tuning in, we're connected with the phone in the Manchester Armory. Each of the people there is allowed only 5 minutes on the telephone. So the people from Philadelphia got together and formed a line outside the telephone booth, and they're each sharing their 5 minutes with us this afternoon on Fresh Air. We've heard from Bill Moyer and Pete Hamill and David Packenhurst. Again, these are the people who were incarcerated in the armory because of their civil disobedience staged at the Seabrook nuclear power construction site. These are all people who believe that nuclear power is a great hazard to society, and instead of handing out leaflets, I guess at this point they're deciding to...
Hello, Terry.
Hello, who's this?
This is Amy Keatsman.
Hi.
Hi.
How are you?
Oh, I'm pretty good, a little tired.
So far, everyone we've spoken to seems to have a cold. Are you in good health?
Yeah, I'm in pretty good health. I had a cold earlier in the week, though.
The men and the women are still together in the armory now, huh?
In this armory, they are, yes. In other armories, they've tried to separate them. One thing I'd like to talk about, though, is the amount of training and workshops that have been going on while we've been here.
Uh-huh.
It's really been exciting for me because I'm a trainer. I do a lot of nonviolence training, and I've had a chance to... reach out to a lot of people, and so have other people. We've been having workshops on nuclear power and how it relates to the economics and politics of the country and how it relates to third world countries and just all kinds of issues like that. Workshops on grassroots organizing, on meeting facilitation, on the history of nonviolence. And it's been really exciting how many people are getting educated while we're here in prison.
Do you think that an action like the one that you participated in, the civil disobedience action at the site of the plant, is going to prove to be a powerful technique in preventing nuclear power plants from being built?
Yeah, I think it is. I think it's what's happening is we are bringing the issue of nuclear power to the forefront and just taking this action and putting ourselves on the line makes other people aware of how strongly we feel and allows them to feel their feelings strongly also and to put pressure on various people. And already we've had different people make statements about the effect of this. I don't know whether anyone's mentioned. I can't remember the man's name, but he's the head of the Federal Energy Administration,
mm-hmm.
And he said he felt that this kind of demonstration meant the end of nuclear power in the United States. And for someone in a position like that to make a statement really indicates that, for me, that this kind of action is really effective.
You know, it's interesting in some of the newspapers, the coverage about the demonstration was as if the people were participating out of a strong sense of nostalgia for the 60s when there were lots of demonstrations. I suspect that that has little to do with it.
Yeah, I think it has little to do with it. I think it's clearly, from what I've seen, most of the people just feel so strongly about the issue of nuclear power, and many of them have never done anything like this before. Many have had experiences in the anti-war movement and in the civil rights movement, but for many, this is the first time they would even dream of doing anything like this, and it's because they feel so strongly that we shouldn't have nuclear power, that it's dangerous, and that it's a technology that we just don't want.
When you were demonstrating, were you was anyone hurt in the arresting process, or did that go fairly smoothly in the sense that no one was hurt in the process?
I was impressed with how smoothly it went. I think for people who made the decision to resist, that is, go limp when the police came up to them, that some people probably were hurt, because there were logs. We were in this parking lot that was stony and rocky, and then there were logs that people had to be dragged over, often with their packs. So some people were hurt, although not badly. But in a way, that was a choice that people made.
Mm-hmm.
But there was no violence from the police.
Okay. It seems that the state of New Hampshire is going to be spending a lot of money if they're going to be bringing you all to trial.
Mm-hmm. I feel badly about that money myself, except that if Governor Thompson had put pressure and if the courts had seen fit to grant us PR, they would have saved themselves all the money that they're spending on us now each day we're in prison.
Mm-hmm.
And so in a way, I feel that the ball is in his court and that he's choosing to have that money spent.
Amy, I'd estimate that we have about 1 or 2 minutes left. In that time, could you maybe talk with us about the kinds of tactics or affinity groups you used during the demonstration?
I'm just really pleased with the whole training idea and the idea of setting up affinity groups. It's meant a whole lot for all kinds of support, for support around thinking around the issue, for support, just emotional support during a situation like this that could get quite stressful. And it seems to me, I think, to be the way to organize in the future, to have small, tight groups that know each other well, or at least have gotten together beforehand and had some kind of training together. I think it's a real step in the right direction.
Are the people from your affinity group in the Manchester Armory with you now?
No, some of us were split up, and the guard is saying I have to get off right now.
Okay, listen, the show's about to end also. So, Amy, I want to thank you very much, and if you could pass on our thanks in Philadelphia to everyone else who we spoke to today. I, and I'm sure many other people here, wish you the best of health and hope that you get through this experience okay.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, and we hope to hear from you when you get back.
Okay.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
Now. Well, I've been on the telephone with four people who are now in the Manchester Armory in New Hampshire. All these people are being held there because of their participation at the demonstration on the site of the Seabrook Nuclear Power Plant 2 weekends ago. They're protesting the demonstration. They're protesting the building of this particular nuclear plant, but obviously their concern is much larger than that. Their concern is against nuclear power in any part of the country or, you know, probably the world. Many of these people have worked on informing people in the Pennsylvania area about nuclear power. I know that some of the tactics they have used before is trying to get information on the hazards of nuclear power distributed by Philadelphia Electric at the Limerick Power Plant, for instance, since they felt most of the information, well, all of the information that was being distributed was pro-nuclear power, and they felt that it was only fair that literature written against nuclear power share the same information racks with that other information. Their tactic as of 2 weekends ago was to put themselves on the line by sitting down and using civil disobedience techniques at the proposed power plant site. So hopefully we'll hear from some of these Philadelphians when they return to the area and find out about the rest of their experience. That's all the time that we have this afternoon on Fresh Air. Tomorrow afternoon at 2 o'clock, we continue with the next part of the Festac series. Again, that's a five-part series that we're hearing from 2 to 3 o'clock for the remainder of this week on Fresh Air, and that will continue next Monday on Fresh Air from 2 to 3 o'clock. So I hope you can join us then. Contributing to this afternoon's Fresh Air has been David Arnold, and the technical director for today's show has been Jay Goldman. My name's Terry Gross. I'd like to thank you for listening, and I wish you a very good evening. You're listening to WUHY-FM in Philadelphia.
National Public Radio in Washington, this is Bob Edwards.
And I'm Susan Stamberg with All Things Considered.